Hello and welcome to Zero Hour. This is Tim Bowen. Today's show is an ongoing series that explores Richmond's thriving art scene and the people that make it happen. Every Friday at 12:30, we sit down in the Richmond Cafe and have lunch with one of these folks. Conversation is live and spontaneous, so pull up a chair and meet some fascinating people. Today we are talking to Ruth Baldwin. Ruth, welcome to Zero Hour. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you, Tim.
Uh-huh. Let's talk just a little bit about your background. I know you're a professor at VCU, but if you could just sort of tell the listeners a little bit about your where you've been, what you've done over the last few years.
Oh, well, that shouldn't take very long, right? I guess just a few points about my background. I grew up partly in Germany, so I have that sensibility of that in my childhood that I think has been part of my work and my thinking. And then I spent a long time in Washington before I came to VCU and did all kinds of politically active stuff. I was chair of the Coalition of Washington Artists. But all along, I was always
like
painting.
Like Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C.,
right,
yeah. And but in terms of really starting to be an artist, I didn't know I was going to be one. And it was really only, yeah. I never studied art in high school or anything. And then I took an art class, and I realized that it was more important than anything else I'd ever done. And it seemed that way to me anyway at the time. And more interesting and more involving everything that I knew how to do.
But you did very well in school, right?
I did. I was a really good student. I mean, right. I knew languages, and I was actually...
How many languages do you speak?
German and a little Italian, some Spanish, French.
Oh, good. Let's do the rest of it in German.
Ah, oui. No.
Kaput.
Yeah, kaput, right. But... Yeah, wir könnten das machen, wenn du willst.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, see, we could do it.
Okay.
But I realized that all of that kind of stuff I'd learned wasn't really compelling for me. And so when I actually first took a drawing class, I thought this is something that pulls everything together in a way nothing ever has. And I was sort of surprised, and I just said, well, I'll just keep doing this until something better comes along, and nothing better has ever come along. So I'm still making.
Well, it's interesting because I think certainly not people involved in the arts, but people not involved in the arts would tend to think someone who's good in languages, someone who's good in music, someone who's good in mathematics, someone who does well in school. That's sort of the antithesis of what you think of, what you might think of as someone becoming an artist. But in many cases, I think you find those connections between music.
Oh yeah,
and certain other art forms. I mean, it sounds like that this was almost the thread that was you were able to sort of run through all of these other interests that you had, and then sort of gather it all together.
Yeah, it's
how's
the thing that pulled it
you?
All together.
Yeah.
How does
having a mastery of mathematics or having a mastery of language or how does that How does art become the center of that?
Well, that has to do a little bit with a paper I'm delivering at a conference next week, and it's called Wandering the Stacks, The Peculiar Nature of Studio Research.
Wandering the Stacks.
Wandering the Stacks.
Oh, okay.
It's as though you go
up. I thought
up
for a second you said watering the stacks. It was like,
No.
Like,
that's
everybody's thinking about this drought we're having.
Drought, right, yeah. No, wandering. And the idea is that all of these things that you know are just sort of little, like books in a shelf in a library, and they're there, and they're kind of always there, but you never know which ones you're going to need at any certain time. And so you kind of wander around, and all of a sudden, certain things pop out, and you need them, like maybe a certain piece of music that all of a sudden becomes very important to me as I'm making a painting, or some other kind of, thing that I've done, a book that I've read or whatever. But I don't know when that's going to happen or how that's going to happen.
I mean, is metaphysical
things
the right word? Or is that,
I guess it would be.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like, here's this very bright sort of, someone who's demonstrated an ability to be left brain, who's also obviously demonstrated an ability to be right brain. Although my theory years ago was that there's more than two sides to our brain, which apparently we have absolutely discovered that there are more than two sides.
Yeah.
But to be able to pull all that together and to be able to make art from it, I find fascinating. I mean, it really is interesting.
Yeah, well, that's where I think this kind of strange research that we do in the studio comes in. Odd things happen. Sometimes I'll just happen to see something that triggers a whole line of inquiry, visual inquiry, that you know, everything else feeds into it. But at the same time, it's not anything I could predict. I'm kind of trying to get around how it is that I make
it. Because our world is so, I mean, you know, we have such an empirical world. We have a world of based on empiricism, based on prediction, based on it's not true unless you can repeat it. And you're sort of flying in the face of that. I mean, in a sense, postmodern, I suppose.
But I don't like that word. You also have to realize that I'm...
Well, it's an impossible. I mean, it's
No. I've been thinking about what matters to me. And first of all, what really matters to me is the 18th century.
Really? Me too.
Oh, really? Well, no, it's in the air. It really is. When the millennium
happened...
What
matters to me is the 18th century.
Totally.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, it's all... My influences, my ideas come from there. I went to Paris in 2002 for 6 months.
So you obviously have thought about, read about the 18th century, because I wouldn't even know where to begin to say that my own sensibility is revolving. What does that even mean, the 18th century? Yeah, what does that mean?
Well, in art, obviously, it means Rococo. It means Boucher. Uh-huh. It means a kind of an amazing time of decadence, or I almost call it, to paraphrase a show that was at the Met recently in New York, it's glitter and doom, you know. Mm. It's this period when there's an incredibly phenomenal sense of refinement and beauty that is underlaid with a kind of an incredible feeling of doom. And so in some ways, I feel like there's a relationship between that and some of what's going on with America today. We're an empire, but we're an empire that is having problems. We are the richest people in the world, but we can't afford health insurance for half our population. I mean, right. So that there are all these kinds of kind of strange intersections, I think, sociologically and politically, which are somewhat like the 18th century.
Hmm. So let's talk a little bit more about this, because you are going to give a paper on this, and one of the things you're addressing is how do artists find information that influence and inspire their work. And what you're talking about is that this happens not necessarily in an intentional way, although it could, but it almost seems as though intentionality takes something away from it.
Yeah.
You're
absolutely right about that, because our experience and the potential for experience is so much greater than any of our intentions could possibly be.
And what you're saying, which I find interesting, is you're saying, well, no, there's a whole other universe out there of chance. There's a whole other universe out there of opportunity if you're open to it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you could talk about that.
Yeah, it's...
Because it sounds like that influences your work a lot.
What I try to do is I try to place myself in places where something might happen, and that's about as specific as it gets.
Right.
And so that, for example, means that travel is very important to me. I find that when I travel, the minute I get on an airplane or a train or a bus, it seems half the time I'm starting to write poetry. In other words, a whole new side of me is opened up and is receptive in a different way than it is when I'm sort of just here.
Right.
And so that kind of receptivity to the potential for a new thought or a new idea is really expanded when I'm in a strange place or when I'm looking at something for the first time or in a fresh way. And of course, that really extends for me to looking at paintings in museums. I love being able to go into a museum as opposed to looking at a painting in a print or in a slide, where when I see the painting in actuality, I immediately say, ah, yeah, it's a big person standing there. But then I see a little tree, you know, behind them, or a tiny animal or a bit of a flower, and my mind and my body really almost physically wanders into that painting, and I invariably find new things in even very old art that really trigger whole big piles of work for me.
Really?
And it's very physical. It's a very physical sensation.
Tactile.
Tactile, yes. That's
really
the word I've been using in terms of describing the way an artist understands things and translates them into making work. It's something that is, of course, we're seeing, but when we see, it's as though we're activating a tactile sensibility immediately in the process of looking.
Hmm.
And such that I feel that when I'm looking at a painting, I'm actually smelling it, I'm sensing it.
Does this hold true for abstract paintings too, or not so much?
Well, I think the narrative content is clearly a part of it that makes it easier. If you're looking at a bush, you can relate to a bush. But no, I think it is true. You know, there is that sense of being able to follow a stream of redness or being overwhelmed by a giant piece of blue that does that. But for me, because of my interests, I'm more interested in the narrative of, say, the 18th century painting.
Well, let's talk about that, because your work has not always been about 18th century imagery. Is that right? I mean, I don't know.
It's always been figurative. Up until recently, up until really going to Paris in 2002, for many years it was more involved with a kind of an expressionistic take on mythology or even sometimes Bible stories, but all based in...
How'd you get to mythology?
Well, I think if you look
Was there a moment?
Well, there was, really. And that goes also to, as you have a longer life as an artist, you find that sometimes the shifts you make are gradual, and sometimes they're very fast. And in the mid-80s, I went to Greece, and I'd always been predisposed to thinking about myth and loving Greece in the abstract, but when I actually got there and experienced it, it produced a real revolution in my work. And amazingly, I came back to my studio after that, and within a matter of less than a month, my painting completely changed. And in fact, that's the painting that...
When you say completely changed, you mean the subject matter changed?
The subject matter changed. It went from being kind of expressionistic with lots of colors to red, white, and black.
I wanted to
paint fast. I had tons of emotions and feelings from Greece that I felt I had to just get them all down as fast as possible. And I eliminated most color. It was just a really radical shift based on the experience of that place. And I think what happened to me in Paris in 2002 was similar. I think that's what's led to this and love of everything pretty, rococo, you know, brilliant colors, linear patterns, overlays, and textures. And
sounds like this sort of wonderful marriage between intellect and emotion.
I guess that's what art is, right? I mean,
yeah, but I mean, you don't, but not everybody, I don't know that I've heard people... Too many people, they seem to be sort of in one camp or another. You seem to be sort of wandering back and forth.
Well, there's some great work being done right now by an art historian named Melissa Hyde in the area of Boucher and Boucher studies, which I didn't know when I went to Paris. I kind of just fell into Boucher as again, one of these strange things that happens to you. And when I came back, then I began to realize that I wasn't the only one. And in fact, in the early 2000s, getting interested in Boucher.
He's
a guy.
Well, talk about him, because I don't know that everybody listening knows who Boucher is.
Well, he's an 18th century painter, and he's the famous court painter for Madame de Pompadour. So he painted all those frothy pictures of her in incredible dresses in gardens and so on. But for a very long time, in fact, most of the 20th century, the idea of beauty was something that was sort of anathema. And so all of these beautiful Rococo images were just thought of as being... almost kitschy.
Yeah.
And so it's really only been in the last 10 years or so, with our ability to kind of refocus on beauty in a new way, that we're able to also look at these Rococo paintings again. It's taken hundreds of years for us, 100 years for us to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And I'm excited about that.
Yeah. Because, you know, beauty was sort of an anathema.
Yeah.
It was, I mean, it was like... Well, anybody could do beauty. I mean, you know, anybody could, literally, of course you couldn't, but that was almost the attitude, was if it's beautiful, it's dismissible.
Exactly.
It's kind of, it was kind of like the dumb blonde.
Yeah, exactly.
It was the dumb blonde of art.
That's exactly,
you know, beauty
that's
was the dumb blonde of art.
Modernism sort of did. It looked at how beauty had become by the end of the 19th century with artists like the French artist Bouguereau. Beauty had become sort of overly sort of simpering and sweet, I guess. Mm-hmm. And so it had to be kind of trashed for most of the 20th century for us to kind of reclaim it in a much more wonderful way. And when we think about it, one of the things I also enjoy, and I think is part of my work, is there's a lot of artists, particularly women artists, who engage in not just beauty, but ideas of prettiness and girly stuff and frothiness. And so, again, it's this Rococo kind of sensibility, people like Karen Kalimnik or Lisa Yuskevich, that they're bringing back into art and is coming back into art.
Okay, well, let's take a short break. This is Tim Bowring, and you're listening to WRIR 97.3 FM, Richmond's Indie Radio. It's radio for the rest of us. We're talking with Ruth Baldwin, a professor at VCU, and we're talking about her work and life as an artist. What is beauty to you? What is it? Is it Is it emotional? Is it is it visual? Is it intellectual? Is it all of those things? Is it? I mean, what makes the difference between kitsch and beauty? What, you know, what makes the difference between sentimentality and beauty?
Well, I think one answer is you know it when you see it.
Kind of a tough question.
At least I know it when I see it. I mean, I have, you know, just from a personal standpoint,
right.
If I look at a Thomas Kincaid, which some people find beautiful, I right. it doesn't move me. But
right.
if I look at a Boucher painting of Madame de Pompadour reclining on a couch, I almost, you know, I get very excited. I mean,
really?
It's stimulating. And so that's my own useful definition, is that when it really rewards me with pleasure.
Yeah.
Beauty is about pleasure.
Uh-huh.
And then, of course, you say, how do we define pleasure? If pleasure really is looking at a glow-in-the-dark Thomas Kincaid cottage,
right.
then, you know, people have different kinds of pleasure. And so there you get into hierarchies of pleasure and what is, you know,
yeah,
that's a
right.
whole other
that's
big
a whole
issue.
That's a whole other issue.
But I think it is pleasure, and for me, beauty is pleasure.
Oh, this was something that you gave me that I wanted to read to you and just sort of get your reaction. My attraction to landscape is increasing. Recently, I've been wandering around a collection of paintings in the Virginia Museum, which is rather unique. It is Paul Mellon's collection of sporting art, French and English horse and dog paintings, which form a pendant to my interest in 17th and 18th century swagger portraits of royal and eminent figures, which I think is a pretty gutsy thing, actually, you know, especially for a woman artist. For a woman artist to cop to being, you know, attracted to beauty. And then the other thing, to say that you're interested in these 17th and 18th century swagger portraits. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, again, it comes out of just my long-term commitment to the figure and painting the figure. And I think, you know, having gone and sort of found Madame de Pompadour painted by Boucher, I began to be more interested in what are these machines, these huge portraits all
right.
about. And,
right.
and I also went to Scotland with VCU summer before last, and so I got a chance to see a lot of wonderful British and Scottish paintings of, you know, kings and queens and stuff. And I just began to realize, first of all, what stunning paintings they are. They're just so wonderful as paintings. And then that really led to what is a tremendous surprise for me, and that is that all the years I've lived in Richmond, like many people, I've kind of dismissed Paul Mellon's collection
right.
of sporting art. Which
yeah,
are the
it's that other horse. Room. Right.
Yeah, that funny room
that
nobody
funny
goes
room
into,
goes,
but
yeah,
somehow
oh.
it has to be there, or he wouldn't have given you all the other stuff, so
right.
you have to show this. And I always thought they were kitschy. And then really over about the last year, and especially after coming back from England or Scotland, and also I did some landscape painting in Cornwall that summer,
mm-hmm.
which I think seeped in as well. But I began to look at those paintings, those horse and dog paintings, with a different eye. And I began to see how really exciting they are and how beautiful they are and how compelling they are as images. And so there's...
Can you
there's
talk about that in any more depth? I mean, when you
yeah.
say exciting, I mean, you know, that... Or compelling or...
Well, first of all, they really are a huge genre,
mm-hmm.
and they're a genre that's been completely dismissed.
Right.
So I think part of it is the excitement for me of looking at something that people don't look at. For example... I went to our slide library at VCU, which is quite extensive and has, you know, thousands of slides
mm-hmm.
of
mm-hmm.
all kinds of art. But they don't have any of those dog and horse paintings. And so I thought, boy, what does
this
mean?
None of those dumb horse paintings.
I mean, there's George Stubbs, who's a
yeah,
magnificent
right,
painter, and
right.
he's recognized, and there are some of those. But, I
mm-hmm.
mean, then there are many, many other painters like Wooten and others who just are not... you know, sort of in the canon of what we accept as art that would be in a slide library. And so I find that intriguing as well. It's partly just that this is a whole big aspect of art that's been dismissed.
What's given you permission to, I mean, outside of yourself, what's given you permission to keep pursuing this fascination with beauty? Fascination with the, and also I think technical
yeah.
aspects of it
oh,
too.
Yes,
I mean,
it
they're
is.
Incredibly
I mean,
complicated.
That's a good point because
yeah.
my brushes have really changed. I used to
really?
Use big brushes, and
uh-huh.
I would always tell students, always use the biggest brush you can. And now I'm buying these like 00 little brushes, and my brush collection has greatly expanded at the same time. It's all these teeny brushes, and so I am making. I'm slowing down as a painter. I
mm-hmm.
used to paint very, very fast. Now I actually paint much more slowly.
Really? How long does it take to do a painting now?
Well, it used to take a day or two, even for a big painting sometimes.
Right.
Maybe a week. And now I can spend months on a painting on and off, but really quite a long time.
Yeah. And what's the imagery? I mean, I've seen, you showed me some images of, you know, of, I mean, these are really...
The landscape is coming in.
These are 18th century images.
They are. They're sort of women in these very wide dresses, but they're abstracted in the sense, increasingly I'm doing them almost as decorative patterns and overlays of color and stuff, but still with very, hopefully...
You mean in an abstract sense?
Somewhat. I mean, they're not as quite as descriptively realistic, say, of actual drapery as they might have been just, even just a year ago. But the faces are still very realistic, made up, but realistic. Mm-hmm. It comes out of my imagination for the most part, but also looking at a lot of these images and putting them, synthesizing all this stuff. And sometimes I'll steal, as I say to my students, you know, steal it.
Steal it, right.
And so, I mean, there's images where I've pretty much stolen a horse from the dog and horse paintings directly and tossed it in.
That's such a great thought. Go to a museum, steal an image,
the art,
toss it in your painting.
Absolutely.
something completely beyond my comprehension because I can't reproduce those kinds of images, but wonderful that indeed you can. Your students, do you find that students, I mean, VCU is not exactly known for being a school of the arts as perceived as beautiful. as a matter of fact, there's probably people down there right now sort of retching in the gutters as we talk about this. So how does that work for you? I mean, it really is courageous.
Well,
you follow this journey.
One strength, though, of our department, painting and printmaking, is in fact that we have a very diverse faculty, and I'm definitely part of being diverse.
Right.
And it's true. When I first came to VCU, my God, 19 years ago now, I was kind of overwhelmed by how much just sort of this idea of process art and expressionism and abstraction was really a very dominant force in the school. But I've always been figurative. I've taught life drawing over many years, and in the last just 2 years, my students have really pushed me to teach a painting class that's completely devoted to the figure. And so now I'm offering that class, and it's very popular.
It is.
Students really want to get into it, and we dress up models in 18th century costumes from the theater department, and we make sets with drapery and globes and flowers, and they
love the kids. Do the students talk about beauty? Do they, or are they just talking about making art? Do they see it in that context?
I think they do. I mean, I think we have conversations here and there. You know, what is the sublime? What is beautiful?
Right.
I mean, those things do come up. And I think they come up more in the context of trying to make paintings that reflect the history of some of those ideas.
So any shows coming up? Anything where anybody can see your work?
Any shows coming up? Well, I just had a few shows now.
Did you?
One in California, and then I was in a group show here in Richmond at Paige Bond's Gallery. I had a large figurative painting in that pink show. Mm-hmm. So no, at this point, they'd have to come to my studio.
Yeah. Okay. Alrighty. And no website, right?
I do have a website.
Oh, you do?
Yeah, I do.
What is it?
And it's got most of the new stuff on it. It's www.ruthboldwin.com.
Okay. Spell that whole thing.
It's RUTHBOLDUAN, which is me.
All right. Well, you're not going to believe this, but we're out of time.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. Zips by.
Boy, we must have really talked a lot the last time. God, we must have done two shows in one.
Really? Well, we did, actually. It was almost 40 minutes. But anyway, for those of you out there listening right now, the last time we did this, my whole entire equipment crashed. So we're trying to redo this thing. Anyway, I just want to thank you for joining us. And I want to thank you folks for tuning in and listening to Zero Hour. We're on the radio every Friday at 12:30. And as you probably have guessed, we're on WRIR 97.3 FM. It's indie radio. It's radio for the rest of us. So, thanks for coming in. We'll see you next time.